I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Enough of war and politics, for now. Enough of corruption and cruelty. The time has come, the walrus once said, to speak of other things. So this hour on The Connection, we are opening our books on the poetry of love. We have invited one of our favorite professors back for a two-part series that will start us off today with the sonnets of Shakespeare and take us this time tomorrow into Philip Larkin's contemporary love poems. It is a comparison of sorts, but let's be clear about this. This is not a survey. There is no compare and contrast question on the final exam. In fact, you'll be happy to know there is no final exam. We're simply tipping time's fickle glass on its side for a couple of hours to consider the ways that affairs of the heart creep into the rhyme and meter of two very different poets. First up, Shakespeare. Like to the lark at break of day arising from sullen earth, sings hymns at heaven's gate. And we want you to join us with your own ideas about love on the page. Has it been forever contaminated by those hackers at Hallmark? Have the darling buds of May been sullied by roses are red and violets are blue? Do Shakespeare's sonnets stand the test of time, or does 21st century love need a new bard? Our numbers are 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Girintosh is our guest. He's a fellow at St. Catherine's College at Oxford University. He teaches English literature, including the works of Shakespeare and 17th and 18th century poets. He's joining us from the BBC studios at Oxford. Welcome to The Connection.
Hello.
It's nice to have you here. Tell me why it was, in helping us map out this look at love poetry, that you chose the sonnets of Shakespeare as perhaps the best place to start our conversation.
Well, Shakespeare is, I think, the greatest love poet in the world. But also, when you look at the sonnets, they're perhaps a little more complicated than seems at first sight.
See, I went back to my English literature text and saw under a list of romantic poets, Burns and Blake and Wordsworth, Coleridge, Lord Byron, Shelley, Keats. They didn't list Shakespeare there. He's listed as a dramatist, excuse me. And I wanted to know whether or not it's important to set aside his work as a playwright and look at him as a poet, as a love poet.
Well, he is, of course, the greatest dramatist of love also. And the sonnets were probably written about the same time as The Merchant of Venice, which is a play which is partly about love and also about violence.
Now, we want to look at three of the sonnets tracing Shakespeare's love, and I wonder if it's worth noting, just before I ask you to read the first one, Michael, whether or not it's important for us to know at this point that the love he's professing is love of a young male companion or friend rather than a woman.
Well, you raise an interesting matter. This poem has, I think, been addressed by many men to their girls and many girls to their men over the centuries. That's what has made it such a famous love poem. Shall I perhaps read it first?
Please.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou own'st, nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. Now, when that, I think, is taken by itself, people read, I suppose, 97% of it, and they think, really, that the poem is saying, my love for you is going to make you live forever. And in a sense, that's what we all feel about the person we love. If you take a slightly closer look, it is, of course, the poem that's giving life to the loved one, not so much the love. And to be very strict, those famous lines that you began with, shall I compare thee to a summer's day, thou art more lovely and more temperate. That's what we know and feel about the people we most love. They're not just attractive, they have a temperate character. And it's that temperate beauty of character that makes them, as it were, triumph over the fact that rough winds spoil May's buds and so on. If you look a bit more severely, however, there's nothing about the temperate character in the poem. It's just there at the beginning. It's a wonderful thought. Now stand back and see the poem in sequence. It is addressed by an older man to a young man whom he is passionately in love with for his beauty. And it's quite clear as the sequence goes on that this young man is certainly not temperate. He's selfish, he's narcissistic, he's very beautiful, but as the poet Auden once said, beauty corrupts and absolute beauty corrupts absolutely. And perhaps many older people who are very attracted by the beauty of younger people of whatever sex, one sort of knows that probably it's going to be a stormy ride. And the sequence is certainly about a very stormy ride.
Now, is it also quite clear, Michael, that this is an autobiographical poem? I mean, this is another one of the debates about whether or not Shakespeare, as such an amazing artist with the English language as he is, was writing directly about what was in his own heart, or writing to make us believe that what he was writing was in his own heart, but really just playing around.
Yes, one simply doesn't know. And you could apply this argument to his plays. If Shakespeare was writing about his own heart in Macbeth and in King Lear, my God, what a heart it was. I mean, being a great genius, if you like, what he has done is to create a poem rather like Robert Browning's poems in the 19th century, where there is a fictive character. It seems awfully like Shakespeare in the sense that this person is a poet and so on. But nonetheless, he's a fictive character. We call him Shakespeare for ease of reference. And the sonnets, written as a whole, or read as a whole, is really a tremendous, bold, unusual love story. We poets live on the dangerous side of things, said the 19th century poet Browning. And this is certainly on the dangerous side of things with regard to love.
So it's important that we not pluck number 18 out of the context of 126 or 154, but see it as a chapter or a part of that longer love story?
Well, it's very interesting to see it for what it is in sequence. And you can pluck it out, and it's wonderful by itself. And taking it by itself, one might make another point about this older man who is terribly attracted to this very beautiful young man. The sequence is utterly lacking in the sort of titillation which could occur in these contexts, and certainly did occur in Shakespeare's contemporary Christopher Marlowe, who very outrageously would say things like, a man who loves not tobacco and boys is mad. In Marlowe's poem, Hero and Leander, there's immense sort of fairly superficial, frivolous, erotic titillation. That doesn't occur in Shakespeare. It's as if love, in whatever context, has an awful lot in common with other contexts.
But doesn't he play with the words a lot, Shakespeare? I mean, if you want to look for something naughty or erotic or filthy in a Shakespearean sonnet, can you not take a word like his own name, Will, and say, ah, yes, but this refers to his genitals, and this refers to, you know, what the young boy would do, and so on and so on?
Certainly. I mean, if you're looking for something naughty, you can always find it, in my opinion. And let me take a case in point. A very late sonnet we're not going to look at begins with, love is too young to know what conscience is, yet who knows not conscience is born of love. Now, the naughty reading of that is to take the word conscience and the way that it was often a play on a lady's sexual organs. I don't take it that way at all. If you take the greatest description of love in the world, It is, I think, in the Bible, by St. Paul, in 1 Corinthians 13, where he says that love is the supreme quality of life. It's more important even than faith that can move mountains. It's more important than giving all your goods to the poor. If you do it without love, as he's going to define it, it profits you nothing. And then we get to the definition. It is. Love suffers long and is kind. Love envies not, vaunts not itself, is not puffed up, does not behave unseemly, seeks not her own, is not easily provoked, rejoices not in wrong but in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. In other words, it's a wonderfully wide definition of love. I can't think of a definition of love that is wider. And you may say, well, all this is about spiritual love, but come on, you know, who is truly in love does not see that kindness is crucial in the relationship, that it is likely to involve long suffering, that envy is something that destroys love, that true lovers do not seek their own, and above all, that if you rejoice in the truth, your love is likely to develop and grow and be wonderful. And it seems to me that is the love of Shakespeare's sonnets. Fine, there is an erotic subtext, and a lot of erotic subtext, but it's subtext rather than text. And it seems to me that's a crucial distinction.
I asked you
Marlowe, the titillation is the text.
I asked you a couple of minutes ago whether or not you couldn't see it as you know, the art of a man who has the ability to manipulate words as brilliantly as he does, or whether or not it is just Shakespeare's heart there on the page. And you said you can look at it both ways. Which way do you look at it, Michael?
Oh, I look at it. I'm an idealist and a lover. I believe in hope. I believe in the paradoxes of love. Even in that biblical text, of course, there's plenty of paradox. You know, you rejoice in the truth, but notice the end. You bear all things, you believe all things, you hope all things. There's that wonderful statement in the sonnets, I believe her though I know she lies. So, you know.
So this is the man's passion, squarely on the page for you. He's not playing at something here.
Well, he can play as well. I think that it's a terrible feature of modern life that we have to limit things one way or the other. But I think there is a huge difference between love in Marlowe's Hero and Leander, where the titillation is really absolutely up top, and there's not so much of the other aspects of love, and Shakespeare's sonnets, where it is this wider sense of love that's up top. And OK, you can naughtily dig about and find titillation, and it may well be there, but that's the priority.
And perhaps one of the more interesting aspects of taking a look as we are this hour at love poetry is figuring out who it's for. If Marlowe is hoping to charm an audience with his wit, what's Shakespeare doing with his sonnets? Supreme quality of life, love poetry, this hour on The Connection. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. We're back after the break to continue our walk through Shakespeare's sonnets. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for NPR.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour, Michael Girintosh, a fellow at St. Catherine's College, Oxford University, where he teaches English literature. And he is with us this hour and this time tomorrow talking about love poetry. Today we're talking about Shakespeare's sonnets. Tomorrow we'll take a look at the poetry of Philip Larkin. And we'd like to hear from you on the program. 1-800-423-8255. Do Shakespeare's sonnets still speak to you? If so, why? Or what's your definition of love poetry? And certainly one of the nicest things about doing a program like this is the opportunity to be read to. And Michael, I'm putting you back to work here.
Thank you.
Have you got the 98th sonnet there at
hand?
Can you read that for us?
Of course. Shakespeare's away from the young man, feeling terrible, and who, when away from their love, doesn't feel like this. From you have I been absent in the spring, when proud pied April, dressed in all his trim, hath put a spirit of youth in everything, that heavy Saturn laughed and leaped with him. Yet nor the lays of birds, nor the sweet smell of different flowers in odour and in hue, could make me any summer's story tell, or from their proud lap pluck them where they grew. Nor did I wonder at the lilies white, nor praise the deep vermilion in the rose. They were but sweet, but figures of delight drawn after you. You pattern of all those. Yet seemed it winter still, and you away, as with your shadow, I with these did play.
Was he, Michael, changing the rules of love poetry at the time? Were other poets saying, wow, what is that guy up to?
Well, I think Shakespeare was always changing the rules of everything. As perhaps you know, he was a magpie. He never invented a story, which we regard as one of the crucial things. So you would actually have a play on at your theatre called Henry IV. And Shakespeare would come and see it. And 3 months later, his theatre would have Henry IV, same cast, same characters, same story, but he would make one or two lethal changes, which just turned it from something ordinary into genius. That's why so many people hated him, I think. There's nothing like thinking you're first rate and then just finding somebody else is millions of miles better. So it's perfectly true people had been writing sonnets. And the idea of being away from the person you love was quite a conventional theme. What I think Shakespeare always does is just play up the humanity, get inside one's skin, be more vulnerable, more forthcoming. And that's why he's so wonderful. He touches our nerves in a way in which lesser people don't. Also, of course, tremendous skill. There's this very small point. Take that first sonnet we looked at, so famous. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May. There's no more popular phrase, in a way, among lovers of poetry than the darling buds of May. Just to make an academic point, who would think that that was the first time the word darling had been used not of a person, but something in nature? And yet, instinctively one feels a sense of added amplitude and richness, which is what love is all about. Here, the sound is so amazing. From you have I been absent in the spring, when proud pied April dressed in all his trim. Trim is almost a rhyme with spring, but all the spring, the zumph, the energy has been taken out of it. Spring, trim. Everything leaped with him, not with me, not with you, him. There's terrible flattening going on. Yet nor the lays of birds, nor the sweet smell, that nor, picking up the syntax, although the syntax is more important than the sensation. And why? Because the person he loves is away. He's desolate.
And so he can be as miserable as he is in this particular sonnet, and it is every bit as much an expression of the same passion when he's just talking about how much he loves this young man earlier in the series of sonnets. It just doesn't have to be an expression of passion or longing. It can be sad. It can be happy. It's still love poetry.
Yes, and in fact, the moods between this poem and the last poem are extraordinary. The young man goes, Shakespeare is bitter, he talks about torture, the young man comes again, the young man is off with a girl, and a girl whom Shakespeare likes, he feels betrayed, he then dreams up fantasy excuses for the young man's behaviour. Some editors in the past actually tried to alter the sequence of the poems to make it more logical. But of course, the whole point of love is that one's moods change and up and down, and you have these violent clashes.
that you don't
Well, sometimes you do.
Logic isn't usually very near the top there. 1-800-423-8255. Michael Girintosh is my guest. We're talking about love poetry. Let's take our first call from Columbia, South Carolina. Mike's with us. Hi, Mike.
Hi, hello. This is a wonderful topic, especially for a long drive that I'm taking today across the sunny Southland. But I love analysis of literature, and to play devil's advocate a little bit, while most of the sonnets, I think, do have a chronological or at least an emotionally chronological order in Shakespeare's life, what if, like maybe the psalmist, you had a biblical reference earlier in 1 Corinthians, the book of Psalms is really just a book of love poems or praise poems or verse. If Shakespeare was an early greeting card writer, what if he wrote some of these things for other people to use in their relationships? Just, you know, maybe he felt them and thought maybe someone could use the words to help explain their feelings to someone, and just that was his only intention.
Well, I think it would be a little more chaotic if that would be the case. I think this is, as it were, ordered chaos in the sense that it does tell a sort of story. But one never knows how great art begins.
But he must have known, Michael, and this may be partly where Mike is taking us here, he must have known that the phrases which stand out, and I like it when you take us back and say, look, darling buds of May, and I think to myself, you know, I've heard that word used in reference to nature at any number of times over the past 20 years and completely forgotten where it came from. And that's part of the delight of going back and reading Shakespeare, is that you find out that so much of what we say actually comes from him. But what about the idea that Mike's suggesting, that maybe Shakespeare knew that he was giving the world phrases and ideas and ways of expressing things that would be used?
Well, perhaps he did. Another example, of course, would be "To Believe Her Though I Know She Lies" from another of the sonnets. I have a feeling myself that Shakespeare, like Mozart, wrote at such high speed. When you look at his output, it is extraordinarily rich. I mean, two great plays a year. And I have a feeling that, yes, he might have been so extraordinarily concentrating and on a high that he knew what he was doing. I have a feeling it was just frantic, conscious activity. He found the best words that he could, and then he was rushing on to the next scene. The director, perhaps, screaming for the next scene, too.
Mike, are you still there?
I am, thank you. And I agree with that, and as a matter of fact, that's probably where I got it from. I'm a musician as well, and just sang Mozart's Requiem earlier this year, and when you think of the excerpts that come from music like that, I've heard them again in a recent blockbuster movie, Mozart's Requiem. I think part of it was used in The Matrix, the latest Matrix movie, or X-Men movie, I think it was. But it's those kinds of references, and where I think of Shakespeare and the greeting cards. I mean, who knows which company may have pulled the Darling Buds of May and developed a greeting card from it, you know? And I think it's wonderful that we look back and see that these roots are there in early literature, both written and in music, that we're using today to kind of continue that passion on and that creativity that is kind of missing today or brushed aside. I think.
And if I can stay with Mozart just for a moment.
Sure.
If you think of the film Amadeus, of Peter Schaffer's play, this business of the magpie who takes something else and transforms it is wonderfully caught there. You may remember that Salieri is with the emperor when Mozart is greeted. Salieri plays a march to greet Mozart. The emperor goes, says, "I think you two should get acquainted." Mozart sits at the piano, plays Salieri's march, and then says, "Yes, it's fine, but suppose we change the key. Suppose I pitch this phrase differently," and suddenly something amazing starts happening. That was Shakespeare, too.
Mike, thanks a lot for your call. Nice to have you on the program.
You're very welcome.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Before we go back to the calls, I wonder, Michael, if I can put you back to work as our reader. And you've chosen to, in our series of three sonnets, to close with number 126. Tell me why we're listening to this one.
This is Shakespeare's farewell, in a way, to the boy. He's now going to move on to the lady whom he is now going to be obsessed with and is having sex with, and she's having sex with the boy as well. And it's a poem which I think in almost any other hands would be bitter or could be nostalgic. The boy has really abandoned him, and yet it's much, much more balanced. Let me go back to my quotation from Corinthians. Love seeketh not her own. Love rejoices in the truth. Love envies not. These qualities seem to me extraordinary in this poem. And the meaning is so dense, let me just quickly say, it begins by saying that the boy can stop time's sickle cutting you down. It can stop time's hourglass. And it's going to end with a legal business. At that time, when you actually paid your debt, you got a quietus. The debt was cancelled, you'd paid it, your audit was over. So those are the meanings of the beginning and the end. O thou my lovely boy, who in thy power dost hold time's fickle glass, his sickle hour, who hast by waning grown. If I can interrupt, suddenly the boy is no longer the sun, the boy is the moon. Who hast by waning grown, and therein showest thy lover's withering, as thy sweet self growest. If nature, sovereign mistress over rack, as thou goest onwards, still will pluck thee back, she keeps thee to this purpose, that her skill may time disgrace and wretched minutes kill. Yet fear her, O thou minion of her pleasure. She may detain, but not still keep her treasure. Her audit, though delayed, answered must be, and her quietus is to render thee. This young man of extraordinary narcissistic beauty seems to not get older, to preserve his charm. Nature is preserving him, but let him just be careful, because in time nature has to give him up. It's a terrifying poem in one sense, and yet utterly, utterly balanced. The boy is lovely. He's abandoned Shakespeare. His lovers wither, but he is still a sweet self. And yet he should be cautious. Those who abuse their power, who abuse their beauty, are not actually going to develop into something wonderful, is the subtext of the poem. Beauty corrupts, and absolute beauty corrupts absolutely.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Newton, Massachusetts now. Stephen, you're with us. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Very nice show. I when I read Shakespeare, I get quite a... I'm at a very high moral level, and I feel he creates an ethic. And I was wondering if he actually created that ethic that I would call an English one, or if he simply was a good voice box for one that already existed.
When you speak about an ethic, Stephen, do you mean an ethic of one person's relationship to another, what is dignified or proper in that relationship?
Definitely. He's your guest. I forget his name. I'm sorry. But
Michael Girantosh is his name, but go ahead.
He's constantly calling on Corinthians, and I don't know if you ever heard Martin Luther King's Levels of Love sermon, but he made the same connection. And I constantly use Shakespeare to come to decisions about what's right and wrong. And I believe the English do as well, and I wondered if that already existed or if he created it.
Michael.
Well, one might make two remarks. In one sense, I think in his time, he was the creator, in that he tends to take these lesser works, of which he's a magpie, and hugely imbue them with vulnerability, love, with the truth of relationships, and their nobility, our potential for nobility, which Shakespeare rejoices in. He does that more than his contemporaries, it seems to me. On the other hand, to say that he really created them, of course, is to, in a way, deny the whole of literature and writing before that point. The age was steeped in Christian thought. It was a Christian age, after all. Darwin had not yet come along. And let me just briefly refer to the first of the great saints, Saint Irenaeus, who was widely read in Elizabethan times. It is Saint Irenaeus's concept that to be truly loving is to be truly alive. And when we are truly alive in this world, we are, quote, the glory of God. You cannot get a firmer statement than that.
Would it be fair to say then, in response to Stephen's question, that perhaps he gave us the language to articulate the way that we regard ourselves within relationships, if he wasn't actually inventing the ethic?
I think he did give us the language. I think he was also reinventing the ethic in his own terms. And that is what great art does in each century.
Stephen, thank you very much for that call. Our telephone...
Is that an answer?
It works for me. And Stephen is listening on the radio, so I'm going to hope that he's nodding in response to your question. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. A chance not only to listen to the sonnets of Shakespeare, but to try and figure out where they fit in our own understanding of love poetry then, love poetry today. Michael Girintosh is my guest, and we're welcoming your calls at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for National Public
Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and we are talking about love poetry this hour. Not only this hour, but this time tomorrow, we'll be making a step from Shakespeare to the poetry of Philip Larkin. A little bit more on that later in the program. Michael Girintosh is my guest. He's a fellow at St. Catherine's College, Oxford University, where he teaches English literature. And we've been talking about the sonnets of Shakespeare. We're inviting you in at 1-800-423-8255. Next to Stephen, who's calling in from Boston. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, how are you today?
Fine, thanks for calling.
All right. I wanted to say how much I appreciate this this forum. It's absolutely fantastic. I think the sonnets of Shakespeare are my absolute favorite works in the English language. For many years, I carried a small copy around my back pocket.
Did you memorize them?
Well, actually, some of them, yes. I'm particularly fond of number 29. I think it's quite a nice one, When in Disgrace with Fortune in Men's Eyes. But I wanted to share today an interpretation of sonnet number 18, which you were discussing earlier, that I had come across some years ago, which I thought was particularly relevant to the discussion. I had heard that Shakespeare's number 18 was sort of a reflection and interpretation of other love poetry of the time, and sort of a reaction to it in saying, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Shall I do this this thing that is so prevalent in the poetry of the time? And he goes on to say that he won't, and that the object of his affection is something much greater. But he does this in the context of a love poem, which I feel is kind of relevant to the discussion today.
Michael, let's hear from you.
Yes, I think that's an absolutely fair point. I think it's going back to my magpie image, all the time Shakespeare is taking up the sort of love poems that other people were producing and saying, the way you lot are doing it is all a bit banal. What actually matters is not, as it were, the nightingale singing or the violets springing up, which are the things you find. What actually matters is the human feeling between two human beings, which may be vulnerable, passionate, angry, unhappy, miserable, but don't take your eye off what love is really, really like.
And is that in the last two lines, then, of that sonnet? So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee?
Well, it's interesting you pick those two up. If you take the poem again in the sequence, it's very interesting. The first 15 or so poems are all telling this beautiful young man that he must marry. He must marry in order to have children, and Shakespeare rather optimistically says any girl would fancy him and want to have his children. Then, at about, I think it's line 30, sonnet 13, he suddenly, for the first time, calls the young man love. And then he starts saying, well, actually, writing poems about you is what matters. And then he knows in sonnet 18 that he pulls it all off. So there's nothing about having children in sonnet 18. Their relationship has actually taken a very significant step forward. He's just saying, look, I love you, I adore you, what matters is my poem about you.
All right, Stephen, thank you for your call.
Thank you so much.
1-800-423-8255 to Glen Carbon, Illinois now. And Doug, you're with us. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I think Professor Garintosh, thanks for being here with us. And first, I wanted to thank you for the book you'd written, Living Proof, which really has helped me and my wife through our struggles with cancer. And I wanted to thank you just in person for that as well. And to
thank you very much
for being here. Sure.
Just a quick aside for people, Stephen, who may not be familiar with the book. Michael's book, Living Proof, A Medical Mutiny, tells a remarkable personal story of Michael's own battle with cancer and his decision not to take some of the Western prescribed medicine. Michael, you're what, 10 years now?
I will be 10 years in the spring. Please, not any of the normal Western prescribed treatments, which...
I read the book, and then it was actually Judy Swallow who sat and did the interview with you here on the program. And for those of you who are interested in hearing it, you can find it by going to the search page of our own archives and listening to
Michael's. But I give my love to any cancer sufferer. It's a terribly, terribly difficult decision, and I'm not saying for one moment that anyone should do what I do, though I think it's always worth considering.
I'm sorry for that aside. Doug, back to you.
No, that's okay. And one brief comment quickly. I would say for anyone out there that the book, for me, was as much about hope. I think that within the context, you're often not given much to go forward with as a cancer patient. And finding a book like Michael's is a way to find a way to stand up and act in your own behalf. And that action itself is a healing property. You know, it really gets you set on the road to understanding what you can do for yourself as well. So thank you again for that, Michael.
All right, to the sonnets, Doug.
Sure. I just had one thing to say. With the last caller, Professor Garintosh, you said Shakespeare sort of ends saying, you know, this my poem about you, which, you know, I think sort of reflects on a person saying, you know, what I have given is what is important, which is, I think, a little bit more about the self than about the relationship with another. And I think to connect it to something else that you'd said earlier about the speed of composition and how you felt possibly, you know, Shakespeare is writing so much and writing under deadlines and things like that. But I wonder if you see these sonnets as a more considered reflection on art, on life, on love, and using sort of relationships, using the other in these sonnets as a mirror to, you know, reflecting on your own existence.
Certainly it's the case that in this poem, Shakespeare knows he's pulled off a masterpiece. And, I mean, you know, it's all there from the beginning in the exultancy of the language and so on. So although I quoted Corinthians and love seeks not her own, actually, of course, Shakespeare is saying, in a way, you thank your lucky stars who've got me writing this wonderful poem about you.
Very soon,
of course, he's going to complain about the young man torturing him and abandoning him. And another poet is going to start writing poems to the young man. And that actually really, really, really annoys Shakespeare, almost annoys him more than anything else.
Do you feel it more of a battle for posterity within these sonnets as well, versus maybe thinking in terms of the plays as something that you make money with or that you live with or that is a part of your daily work?
Possibly, but then, of course, I'm sure Shakespeare knew that some of his plays were just mind-bogglingly wonderful. It would seem to me very strange if he didn't. So I just think one's in the hands of a genius, really, with Shakespeare, and normal rules don't quite apply.
I read somewhere, Michael, that at the time that Shakespeare was writing, poetry carried more weight. The plays were kind of something that you did, I don't know, to put bread on the table, to pass the time between poems, but it was the poetry that mattered more than the plays.
Well, I suspect that's an argument which has got two sides to it. It's perfectly true there were aristocrats who wrote poems which they circulated among each other in manuscript. I don't think there was much money to be made from publishing poems. And certainly the Queen, and indeed the King, James I, went to Shakespeare's plays and commissioned them. We know, for example, at a very early performance at Twelfth Night, if not the first performance, the Queen was sitting there translating it herself to the Duke d'Orsino, Orsino in the play, who was on a state visit from Italy. So I think plays were pretty grand, too.
All right, Doug, thank you for your call. 1-800-423-8255 to Kate now, who's joining us from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Kate.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for calling.
Great. I love this show, and I'm really, really pleased to be hearing about Shakespeare's sonnets today. I actually teach the sonnets, not quite on the level of your guest, but I teach the sonnets at Providence College in Providence, and I love watching the journey for my students and, of course, myself with each time of going through these poems and this poetry, this incredible heightened poetry, and watching their exploration where they really start to make the connections that this is still applicable, and then sort of leaving my class and leaving my course having been really transformed. And I myself, at the end of every semester for them, I always do Sonnet 29 and explain to them that, you know, it's when in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state and treble deaf heaven with my bootless cries and look upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed, desiring this man's heart and that man's scope with what I most enjoy contented least. Yet, in these thoughts, myself almost despising, happily, I think on thee. And then my state, like to the lark at break of day arising from sullen earth, sings hymns at heaven's gate. For thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings, that then I scorn to change my fate with kings.
Yes, it's a most wonderful poem.
Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful.
And it's always done for love, but it's also about love of things and love of people and love of each other, you know, not just romance and...
And I'm sure I'm now just saying something you say in your class. If you take it in sequence, of course, it has another resonance. For thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings. It's not thy sweet love enjoyed at the moment. Shakespeare's in one of his problems with the wretched young man whose neck I generally want to wring. But I suppose, too, another thing you're saying is something of huge importance, and I think this is implicit in what you say. One of the most eminent psychotherapists in Britain at the moment is called Brian Thorne, and in a recent book he actually makes the terrifying point that in our culture now, the experience of intimacy in the full sense, the rich sense, is actually rare. And Professor Thorne goes on to say that he sometimes has the appalling thought that fully loving people are becoming an endangered species. Now, if you ever feel that, then Shakespeare's sonnets really should be taught to everybody, it seems to me.
You clearly get as much pleasure reading the sonnets or just savoring them here on the radio program as you do in front of your class, as you probably did the very first time you read them, Michael. I mean, to me, that says more about, and listening to Kate read as well, it says more about the power of those words, I think, than anything else.
Well, they're wonderful, of course, like Shakespeare's plays. And I think that if I read Kate correctly, what gives her such pleasure is the sense of her pupils expanding and unfolding. I actually remember asking a question once to a rather grim undergraduate who'd come from Wales, and I was getting nowhere. And after about 5 minutes, he looked at me and said, "I wish I could do his voice. I can't. Am I to understand, Mr. Gerintosh, that you wish me to expand myself?"
To which you
said, to cry, "Yes, yes, yes."
But no, I don't think it's going to happen in this class.
Well, no, I think it did quite.
Did it?
Oh, yeah, well done.
All right, Kate, thank you for your call. Now, a quick bit of business for tomorrow's program, Michael, because you've chosen to swing us from perhaps the best-known poet in the English language to Philip Larkin, someone who's not really quite as well-known.
He's perhaps better known in this country than in the States. He should be tremendously well-known. One of our most eminent literary critics, John Carey, has said that if you don't see Philip Larkin as quintessential to modern literature, you've got a hole in your heart and a hole in your head.
Though he's nowhere near as passionate as our friend Mr. Shakespeare.
No, he, alas, is a poet who, though in one sense a loving man, extraordinarily illustrates the difficulty of loving now, which many people find.
That lack of intimacy you were talking about.
Lack of intimacy, lack of richness, lack of the fullness of that quotation of love I gave you. And I think it's part of a very interesting cultural trend. Do we have a moment for me to talk about it?
We have about 30 seconds for you to talk about
30 seconds, my golly. Arthur Miller, in his wonderful autobiography, Time Bends, talks about the first time he heard the word lifestyle. And he said it marked a transition in modern life from a sense of people as a community struggling to better their conditions to what Miller calls the modern disease, quote, a kind of pointless competition in fashion, clothing, types of car, speech patterns. And I think it's that taking over of emptiness that Kate was militating against when she got her pupils doing Shakespeare's sonnets, and perhaps we look at in Larkin.
Michael, you're back again tomorrow. We look forward to hearing from you then.
Thank you.
Michael Gerintosh, back tomorrow for the second of our two-part series on love poetry. This time we're talking about the work of the British poet, Philip Larkin. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.